Thanks for listening to the Morning Glory Project. I'm your host, Betsy Graziani Fassbender. And as always today, I'm bringing you a story of determination. In this particular case, I'm bringing a story that's not so easy to listen to because there's a tragedy involved. And still, despite that tragedy, because of that tragedy, this is the story of a father who is determined to claim his daughter and to use her loss, the loss of her, as a way of protecting other families from suffering what he's lost. It's not an easy topic, but it's still a hopeful one because it's about taking the tragedies that come to us and making good of them. And we're airing this at a time when there's been tragedy in our nation, when we've watched the death of George Floyd, the merciless and cruel death of George Floyd, and yet that tragedy has mobilized millions. I know his family would want him back, and I would want that for him, just as I would want Michael's daughter back for him. But I also know that we don't have that power. All we can do is take what comes before us and make use of it. So I hope you'll listen to Michael's story. And please know, I'll spoil the ending here. Michael has gone on to build a beautiful family and great joy. And he's one of the most effervescently joyful people that I know. So know that as you hear his dark story. And thanks for listening to the Morning Glory Project. So let me welcome today Michael Lazarin. Michael never set out to be an advocate in the world of parental alienation. He was forced to learn to navigate a twisted legal system when he became an erased, alienated father of his beloved daughter, Audrey Pott, when she was 7 years old. Michael, with his loving family and community of other erased family members, is determined to honor his daughter's memory and transform his family's trauma into triumph. More than that, he wants to protect other families from enduring unnecessary alienation. Michael continues to work so that modern family law reform and shared parenting law pass, together with organizations like Family Access, Fighting for Children's Right, and the Father's Rights Movement. He continues to quest to change community awareness and laws to protect families and our innocent children. Because of a recent precedent-setting court ruling, Michael's nearly two decades of determination will benefit not only his ability to tell the story of his beloved daughter, but it will also help other alienated parents to help to tell theirs. So, Michael, I'm going to take a liberty here just for the sake of our finite time and summarize a bit of your story, and then you help me out with the rest. So you were involved with a woman that to whom you were not married, as is the custom these days, and she was in the process of a divorce, or said she was. You were romantically involved with her, in love with her, in fact, and you were partners in lots and lots of ways. You parted for reasons that are lengthy and all of that, that like your relationships end, mostly because you found out that she wasn't in the process of divorce, and that troubled your own sense of morality. You only later found out that she had a baby and that indeed that baby was yours. You welcomed her back in when Audrey was just a few months old and raised her as a father, as every good loving father would, until she was 7 years old when her mother took her away again and returned again to her marriage. Because you weren't legally married to her and because she was legally married, though many years separated from a husband, he went on as her father, and you were then, legally speaking, erased from Audrey's life. Is that sum up the very beginning part of things?
Pretty much everything is accurate, except that Sheila Pott, Audrey's biological mother, didn't go back to Larry. She actually met somebody else.
Oh, she met somebody else. But because the child was conceived during their legal marriage still existing, the court saw him as father.
Correct.
And you tried and tried and tried. You did all the kinds of legal things that you could possibly do to get Audrey back, but you were denied access to her because of that legal twist. And then events happen, and Audrey took her own life when she was 15, never having seen you again, which is just the most heartbreaking thing that anybody could say, is that you'd lost this child. And then she was so unhappy in her world, and for lots of other reasons that we probably don't have time to go into all the details about, but she took her own life. And you have subsequently been working at trying to claim her as your daughter, and the law prevented you from doing so. So tell me what that was like for you. It would have sent any loving father into orbit.
Yeah, I think any parent, mother or father.
Sure.
So, you know, going through the whole process with the court process has been, you know, eye-opening and very hard on my family. The initial family court procedures cost me my life savings.
And that was when Audrey was living, when you were trying to get custody or shared custody, at least, or at least visitation and access.
Correct. So I found out when I found out that Audrey's mother began another relationship with another man, I went to an attorney to try to gain access to my daughter and fight for joint custody. I ended up finding out that Sheila Pott never got, even though we were together for 9 years, she never finalized her divorce from her husband, Larry Pott, of 11 years prior to me even meeting her.
Right.
So that in itself was a huge shock. And then later I find out in the state of California, an unmarried parent would need to do DNA testing within 2 years of the child's birth in order to be considered her father.
So let me do the math on this. So Audrey is living with you from the time she's a few months old until she's seven. You're acting as her father. You're thinking this is the way this is going to be. And so you, of course, didn't file paternity claims or parental rights claims because you didn't think you needed to. Only then, after when she was seven, you found out that you had to have filed those within 2 years of her birth.
Correct. I mean, the legal terms of it, I'd actually have to file a lawsuit against your mother, and we were together as a happy family. So who in the world would ever do that, right?
Right. So, but because of that technicality, because you didn't claim it in the right period of time, it's like the statute of limitations wore out, or?
Correct. There is the 2 years of statutes of limitations in order to do DNA testing. So a lot of people, including myself, are unaware of that. If you don't do DNA testing and you're an unmarried parent, within 2 years of the child's birth, you're going to be in my situation.
And, you know, these days, lots of people don't get married. They have children, they live together, they cohabitate. So the laws in family court kind of reflect and hearken back to a time when traditional marriage was the most common form of family. And today, families are formed in lots of different ways.
Correct.
So you tried and tried, but you sort of... for lack of a better word, you peeked in Audrey's life through monitoring her on Facebook, and her cousins were still connected to her. Your nieces and nephews were still connected to her, at least one of your nieces. So you got a peek into her life during that time. Is that right?
Correct. So losing custody of your child at 7 years old is devastating in itself. Like I mentioned to you, it did cost me my entire life savings. I spent over $200,000 at that time in legal fees over the 4.5 years trying to get joint custody or even have any type of relationship with my daughter. And then coexisting in the community of the Silicon Valley for the period from 7 until she was 15 until the time of her death. I mean, I only lived 8 miles from where my daughter lived.
And you were never allowed to see her.
And I was never allowed to see her. So that in itself was very, very hard to manage.
Well, I just, every time I visit this story with you, Michael, there's still this jaw-dropping thing, which is that it's still hard to believe that a parent could be utterly erased from a child's life like that, that the family court doesn't protect that. As a therapist, I've been to court many times with families in the past. And, you know, there's always that, you know, in the best interest of the child stuff that gets said in family court. But that couldn't have been in Audrey's best interest to all of a sudden have, I try to imagine what it must have been like for her at seven to be utterly lose you and all of your extended family.
Correct. I mean, it wasn't like she didn't have a relationship. I mean, we did everything, went vacations to Hawaii, San Diego, Arizona every year. I mean,
daily making of lunches and
diaper changing and, just schoolwork and just everything that you do as a father, just loving my daughter. I mean, I'll set things aside. I mean, I love my daughter unconditionally and I still do.
So subsequent to her death, and there's a lot of complicated stuff that led up to her death. There was a statement that, or an event where she was assaulted at a party and there was a claim that she died because of cyberbullying and that kind of stuff. But you have since shown that that wasn't the case, right? That really, what do you think caused Audrey's death?
Oh, it was severe abuse. Just stepping back a little bit, I didn't find out about my daughter's death in any traditional ways. I found out about my daughter's death on Facebook.
Wait a minute. Let's stop there a second. You found out about your daughter's death on Facebook.
Correct. So on September 10th, 2012, I got a call at about 11:30 with my sister hysterically crying, saying that she's came across a post that Audrey had committed suicide. So I immediately reached out to Audrey's mom to figure out what was going on. And amazingly, the person that calls me back is the stepmother.
So Larry Pott had remarried.
Correct.
Somebody else named Lisa.
Correct.
And that's who called you back.
Yep. And basically, Lisa Pott started to blame me for her death because a year prior, my son Connor was born. So her, she had a new baby brother. And I reached out to her via Facebook and let her know that I loved her and I did everything I possibly could to be in her life and that she had a new baby brother, Connor, that was born. And basically, Lisa Pott was blaming me that interaction had caused Audrey to go into a tailspin, and that's why she took her own life.
Oh, Michael, this is the hard part, folks. We'll get through this, I promise. But I know that I know you to be such a loving family man, and such you now have three living children in addition to Audrey, whom you always refer to as your daughter in heaven. So I know you to be such an involved, loving, adoring father that must have just sent you into a spin that you were being blamed.
Well, it did. For a couple months, I had a lot of guilt, as anybody, but then subsequently I'm amazed because I turn on the television and my daughter's story is on international news on CNN being broadcast that my daughter had been sexually assaulted in Saratoga at a party and that she was cyber bullied and all of her photos were shared on the internet. These nude photos of these boys, three boys that assaulted her that, wrote all over her body and had taken pictures and distributed them on the internet. So the story from what originally was blamed on me now had been blamed on a much larger scale now, which was a world scale, on these three boys, which Audrey grew up with. They were her best friends that she grew up next door neighbors and so forth. And the Saratoga, California community. So the story had totally changed.
So let me clarify this too. This was a party. There was misbehavior. Audrey passed out. These guys used exceedingly poor judgment, horrible judgment, and wrote on her body, took a photo. They did not distribute it on the internet, correct?
No,
It was never sent out. And Audrey forgave them and was back hanging out with them. And she didn't see that as a I don't want to minimize what happened because that's horrible, but it was not what the Potts family said it was. It wasn't like she became the object of cyberbullying and that's what sent her into a dither and what caused her suicide. It was that she did a stupid thing. They did a stupid thing. They got back together with her friends and they had moved on, but the abuse in the household that you claim to be present continued.
Correct. So, you know, the first thing that was really surprisingly, shockingly, is that the Pot family would go to the extent to put all the blame on these three boys, at 14, 15-year-old boys.
Yeah, these were not 25-year-olds doing this to a 15-year-old girl. These were 13, 14-year-olds.
And I always ask, where were these parents, right?
Right.
You don't leave your child at a home unsupervised over a weekend, right? I can see overnight, but this is a whole weekend. And then not even know that this happened to your child for, you know, 4 or 5 months later. And then, you know, use the media to significantly change what really happened to the story and tell such a horrible lie on what really happened to my daughter. My daughter was experiencing extreme abuse by the stepmother. And I'm talking physical, emotional, and psychological abuse. I have since then received all of the therapist documents that prove what I'm saying.
Right.
So my daughter was dealing with a situation of domestic violence going on both in her step-parents' home and in her mother's home.
So let me layer this up. So first of all, she's taken from you and your extended family. So she's alienated from the people that adored her. Then she's shuffled around between her mom and stepdad and new kind of step-stepmom, I guess is the term.
And her mom's new boyfriend on top of it.
And her mom's new boyfriend. So she's got a whole nother crew of folks and she's abused there, which is probably what sets her up for getting drunk at a party. And, you know, kids who are troubled end up getting harmed a lot. So it was sort of a setup that could happen. So there's all these layers of things that led up to Audrey's death.
Well, what about this? What about the severe, these adults that were supposed to be taking care of or the best interest of my daughter were lying to my daughter from 7 years old all the way till she's 15.
Telling her that you didn't.
That we didn't exist.
They told her that you didn't exist.
Correct. That I wasn't her. She had no family. I mean, there was no, you know, we weren't her family. So they tried to erase 7 years of this child's upbringing and then, you know, psychologically abuse her until she's almost 15 years old. And then she finds out that what she knew always was the truth for, you know, in her entire life for those 8 years after she was taken from my family was she was just being lied to by these people that were supposed to be caring and loving for her. I mean, that's a lot for an 8, 7-year-old child to endure.
It's a lot for a 50-year-old child to endure. It's a lot for anybody. Well, so Michael, I want to linger here on that moment, on those times, because I know that after Audrey's death, but before you subsequently have, I don't want to say moved on because you haven't moved on, but you've moved through this and built a beautiful life. But there was a time when you yourself were suicidal. You yourself were traumatized. Can you tell me a bit about what that was like for you?
I look back, it was like a bad dream that never ended. You know, I started drinking a lot, looking for something to hide all the pain. So I was just, you know, basically going out with my friends almost every night, just trying to forget what was happening. So that was really taking a toll on me.
And then after her death, Audrey sort of became, they used Audrey's memory as a way to make money. they sued the families of the boys at that party, and they were rewarded handsomely for that. And you were then denied, when you would try to post something about your daughter, what happened?
I was getting DCMA, which is copyright claims against my daughter's anything that her name, her image, or her likeness.
So you were told that she was a famous person, a celebrity, and you were like she was Marilyn Monroe or something, and you couldn't use her likeness, that it wasn't yours to use.
Correct. So there was a film that was made in 2012, and obviously there was a law, the only cyberbullying law in the country, called Audrey's Law in the state of California, was established based upon this false narrative. So when this film was going to be released in 2016, the Pott family knew there was a lot, and their lawyers knew that there was a lot at stake here. So what began in, 2012, I mean, after the death of my daughter, I mean, I even had to go to the extent where they didn't even notify me where my child was buried. So I had to walk cemeteries for almost 2 years just trying to find where my own child was buried.
And as a person, I know that you're a person of faith, and in your faith and in your practice, the gravesite is an important feature for you. So to not know where she was buried was another layer of torture.
Yeah, I finally received an anonymous call from somebody in Saratoga. I still don't know till this day who that was. And they gave me the location, and me and my son went and visited her gravesite. And once again, I was horrified. Not only did these people become famous worldwide with the movie and everything else, received millions of dollars of compensation off of her death, I find my daughter buried, not even really truly buried. I mean, she didn't even, they hid her gravesite in a private cemetery in the hills of Saratoga. And there is like Thomas Kincaid and all these really famous people are buried there. It's a private cemetery. And what I ended up finding was my daughter just had a piece of tin stuck in the ground with her name in tape. Mm. It said Audrey Pott.
So no headstone, no marker, no honor.
No.
So Michael, here's where I want to switch this, because all of that horror, I try to imagine how you got through that. What was it that, I know that what kept you going, the fight for your daughter, but what got you through? Because if anyone meets Michael, I want you to know, if you meet Michael, Michael is the essence of joy. He laughs easily and loves big and is just such an enormously kind and generous and bubbling person. How did you reclaim that? How did you get through the dark part to get back to you?
I think just my faith in God, a wonderful mother and father, a wonderful wife, my children's mother right now, Danette, just having such people that never gave up on me. Mm. And then most of all, my son, Connor. I mean, he saved my life. If it wasn't for him, I don't think I would have been able to survive this.
Tell me what you mean by that. How did Connor save your life?
Well, I remember when this story all started, and it was on CNN. I was in Santa Clara, and my family was Connor and Danette, and were in Arizona. I was living in Scottsdale, Arizona at that time. And I was here in Santa Clara at a friend's house and going through all this when this was on national news. And at that time, I had a very prominent attorney named Gloria Allred. I don't know if you know her from the O.J. Simpson trial.
I do.
She was reviewing my case and then ended up representing me. And I remember I was just, you know, at that time I wasn't eating at all. I mean, I was just probably drinking and just trying to numb myself. And finally Didette came with my son. I think he was 2 years old, and they ended up flying out. And I recall that she told me that I was completely white. I had I didn't even have a color in my lips. And I remember when my son came in, he just ran up to me, and the first thing he said at a 2 year old is, he said, "Papa, you're going to be okay."
Oh.
And
and that was a turn.
Yep. That was the turn.
So it's not just I don't think we can wait for those magic moments, but to say that you became a father again.
Yep.
Right? It's like, oh, wait, I'm mourning the loss of one of my children, but I have a child here.
Yeah. And I had forgotten, because for those 2 years, you know, it was to see your child just being exploited on a world level and news every day. And every day you wake up and you open up your front door, she's in the front page of the morning newspaper. Ugh. You know, it was just nonstop. It didn't end. You know, it went from layer to layer to layer to layer to layer. And my poor son was, you know, he was neglected during that time, because I just didn't have the emotional, physical capacity to absorb what was going on, you know, with Audrey's death.
Well, let me say too, that he was safe. His mother was caring for him.
No,
you just meant that you were neglectful in terms of your being emotionally present with him.
Correct. And even when I was present, I wasn't present. Right.
Right.
I mean, right. My mind was somewhere else. So.
Well, you were grieving, you were depressed, you were stunned and shocked, and you know, it's hard enough. I know sadly from experience that surviving the suicide of a loved one in and of itself is a devastation that's hard to get through. But to have it compounded with all of this, and have it be your child, have it be a child from whom you've been alienated, to not be able to claim her and to post your feelings about her if you'd so choose, all of that. So I want to shift a little bit, Michael, to the recent event, because the other thing that your story illuminates is that the family courts were no friend to you. The family courts are really, they're an industry that makes a lot of money. they make more money when there's conflict, and that the best interest of the child, that adage that we hear, is not always what wins out in court. So the family court was of no help for a lot of time, and you had to keep at it. So what the Pottses did is they enacted, or they sued you, saying that you couldn't use Audrey's name or likeness or image because she was a celebrity, right?
Correct.
So tell me about that. Something about the Fred Astaire law you told me about?
So I was in family court today I've been with the family court. Now I'm done, but I was literally in a battle for 17 years.
First for her custody or at least visitation.
Then I was basically brought into the trial that was going to take place with the boys that assaulted my daughter. Mm-hmm. So the defense team had subpoenaed all my records. I was going to be brought into a trial, but they ended up settling out of court. So I was in court throughout that, the criminal trial of these boys. And then when this film was going to come out, Audrey and Daisy on Netflix, it was actually shown at Sundance Film Festival, and Netflix ended up paying, I believe, $7 to $10 million for the rights of her film for 2 years. The Potts knew that I was going to come out and start speaking the truth, which would damage their credibility. So,
and their income.
I can't state that, but I would think so. Right. So
yeah,
they started hitting me with all these lawsuits. They hit me with 5 lawsuits simultaneously, trying to totally silence me and drain all my financial resources. And one of the things that they did is they went and registered my daughter's name, image, and likeness with the state of California. And And in 2016, I did a press conference with then State Assembly member Nora Campos to bring forward a shared parenting bill, which was televised with all the major news stations in the Bay Area at City Hall. They ended up suing me after that because I had posted a picture of my daughter next to me when I was doing this press conference to the State Assembly members. And so I had won prior to that. They had hit me, like you mentioned, with you four or five other lawsuits. So I went to three trials and won all those cases. And then they ended up registering my daughter's name, image, and likeness to hit me with this final lawsuit, which is called 344.1, which is the Fred Astaire Act, which was used to stop people from using famous people's name, image, and likeness, like Michael Jackson or Prince or, you know, any major celebrity. But what they forgot was that you can't sue somebody when they're trying to change law. So what they were trying to do is silence me, gag me. And it worked for the release of the film in 2016. But I ended up hitting them with an anti-SLAPP lawsuit, which is a First Amendment speech right for violating my First Amendment speech. And I went to the Superior Court, went through trial to that. I actually won.
And this just happened right before the COVID virus shut everything down.
Correct.
You got the court ruling. And what did that court ruling say, and what does it enable other alienated parents to
basically
do?
It's first in the whole country, so there's never been a case, so it's a precedent case. There's never been a case where there was trying to use 344.1, which is a celebrity lawsuit, to try to silence somebody and take away their First Amendment speech rights. So this case law is going to be able to help other families and people to use and cite case law right in their cases going forward to stop them from being silenced.
This is a triumph, not only for you, because now you can come on this program, or you can write a book, you can post whatever you want on social media about your daughter, which is what they were trying to deny you from saying.
Correct.
Because if you were her father, then their story didn't hold together. and by the way, just so folks know, Michael's paternity of this child is not a question. Even if you looked at her, if you looked at Michael, if you looked at her, if you look at Michael's living children, they all look just like Audrey. It's even to the layperson without a DNA order or DNA test, it would be an undeniable thing. And by the way, her mother and stepfather are all blonde and blue-eyed, and you are of Mexican and Asian descent, then that's what Audrey looked like.
Well, not only that, it now establishes in case law, it's going to be in every case law, that I am her biological father.
So it not only lets you say it, but it establishes in law that you are her father.
Correct. I mean, they've never opposed it. The Potts won't oppose it because they know it's absolutely true. Right?
So there's something about that paper validity to you that was transformative, wasn't it? There's something about it saying it in legal record.
Because until today, I was always the man that was presumed to be her father, or, you know, claimed to be her father. I've always been her father. I'm her dad, you know, and nobody was going to take that from me.
So, Michael, you've done this. You've been this daddy warrior for so long. And in the interest of our time here, I want to kind of come to where you are now. Tell me about your life now, particularly now that, I don't want to say the fight is over, because it's not as if you don't still have a daughter to grieve and that it's not so painful, but you don't have to be the warrior that you've been so far, at least on behalf of Audrey and yourself. What is your life like now?
God, it's beautiful. I have three beautiful children. I have Connor's now 9 years old. I got a middle daughter, Bethany Taylor. She's 5. And then I have we call her the she's, all my children look exactly like me, but Danette's beautiful. She's really light. She's French and Swedish and all those really light skinned, you know, blue green eyes. It's Danette. But our youngest is actually a splitting image of Audrey. And she has all the same features, dark features, but she has blonde hair, whereas Audrey had really dark black hair. But Isabella's going to be three. So I'm blessed to have a beautiful, loving, you know, family.
Well, and you're the kind of daddy that is making up for all the years he didn't get with his first child by pouring it all in with these other three and with your wife. And just so folks know, too, you went through the financial hardship of this at the beginning, trying to get custody or visitation with Audrey, but your financial investment of this has been enormous. You know, and you're still coming back, I know, from bankruptcy, literally bankruptcy.
Yeah, I mean, I've poured every cent that I've earned in the last, I don't know, 15 years into this. Mm.
Well, and hopefully with this new ruling, there'll be some correction because some of those court fees will be refunded to you.
I'm going to be, with the winning of my case, I'm going to be allowed to get back all my attorney's fees and costs, which I've spent.
Well, I'll hope for that because that's your kid's college fund, right?
Yeah.
that's that. Well, Michael, if you were talking to anybody about trying to get through grief, do you have anything that you think you learned that you'd like to share?
Never give up, never lose hope, and it never goes away, right? I mean, you're always going to struggle with every day, right? So I try to live each day and know you're going to have your good days and your bad days. But I think in my case, the tragedy has built the building blocks for me to be strong. Mm. And to live life the way it should be lived, right?
Well, Michael, I'm so glad that you could talk with me today. And thank you so much for folks learning about, I know that there are lots of parents, lots of family members, grandparents, aunts and uncles who have been alienated from a child that they love because of the neglect of a parent, because of revenge, because of divorce situations, because of all kinds of reasons. And I hope that your dark story and your light at the end of this tunnel are inspiration to them to keep on going, to keep hope. Your loss of Audrey, the tragedy of that can't be erased in any possible way, but the fact that you have turned it into extra love for your family and for your living children is a testament to who you are. I'm so grateful to know you, and thank you so much for being part of the Morning Glory Project today.
Thank you, Betsy. God bless you.
I'm so touched by my conversation with Michael Lazarin, as I have been during my entire acquaintance with him. I met him several years ago because he hired me to do some writing for him and some speech writing. I've been continually inspired by his tenacity and focus. And at the same time, and Michael would say this about himself, it's also been a function of his post-traumatic stress disorder, that keeps him awake, that keeps him striving, that keeps him moving. So it's a journey not without cost. Sometimes our heroism is called upon, but it doesn't come cheap. And that's the extra bloom, that the tragedy has to live side by side with the accomplishments. The sorrow and the loss lives side by side with what we can accomplish because of it. I'm going to hold on to that. Thanks so much for listening to the Morning Glory Project. I hope that you've found a nugget of inspiration in this conversation and that you'll listen to other episodes and let us know what you think. Offer a review, share it out with friends, and that's what helps us stay around. Now, I encourage you to go out and bloom.